This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome. Glad you decided to listen in today. This is where we talk about what's going on in the economy, what's going on in the financial markets, and what it might mean for you and your money. Joining me on today's program is Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom offers a very interesting perspective on cycles and economic cycles. And also joining me today is the author and publisher of the very popular newsletter, Addicted to Profits, Mr. David Skarica. We'll get his take on what the rest of this year might hold for your IRA and 401k if you're invested in stocks. So I've got a terrific show lined up for you today. Let me also let you know of a brand new resource that we have available. If you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you know that we talk about what we believe might be one of the biggest threats facing you as far as your financial future is concerned. And that threat is the continued devaluation of currency. And one of the questions we get a lot is, should I buy metals? Should I buy gold and silver as a hedge against this devaluation of currencies? So we have a free report available to you. It is a resource that will talk to you about different ways to buy gold and silver, what you might consider, what you want to watch out for, and it is distributed absolutely free. If you'd like to get this report, all you have to do is visit the website shouldibuymetals.com. The website, again, is shouldibuymetals.com. When you go there, just enter your name and mailing address. We'll be glad to send you this free report. Absolutely free of charge and with no obligation. Again, the website to get your free report on whether or not you should buy metals and give you some more information is shouldibuymetals.com. I am pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Thomas R. Pachauri. Tom is the editor and publisher of World Affairs Monthly. You can learn more about his work at worldaffairsmonthly.com. I would encourage you to check that out, and I'm pleased to have Tom back on the program because of his perspective that is very unique, and I know you're going to enjoy my conversation with Tom. And Tom, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks a lot for giving me a call. This morning I'm a little bit more alert than last time.
So, well, great, and it's early where you are. You are on the West Coast, and let's jump right in here. Yes. Talk a little bit, Tom, about the work you've done in economic theory. Just give our listeners an overview as to your work.
Well, I think last time I did mention, you know, briefly that I had a strong impression, you know, when I was a young man, I'm 58 now, when I was a young man that, you know, pardon for the negative thoughts here, but I did have a strong impression that economic science, as they, you know, kind of thought about it, was really quite ridiculous and stupid. And very, very, you know, I don't know what words you want to use, inadequate, just plain stupid. And so I figured, well, Tom, you know, you might be able to do a better job than that. So I struggled for about, you know, 15, 20 years to come up with the ideas that would, you know, improve things. And I did finally do that around 2007, 2008, you know, around that time. And I my main thesis was that we have big cycles, and also that there are three fundamental drivers or sources of economic growth, and those three are energy for power. So you need power, and the source of that power is energy. Then you have ideas or technology or knowledge to get efficiency, so that's the number second one, the efficiency. And then you have the cycle to compel or to get you adaptation. And so those are the three fundamental sources. And then about a year later, I realized that probably wasn't the whole story, and I had to refine that a bit, and I realized that there are probably three secondary sources, and those don't give you what you call organic growth, but they will give you growth by augmenting the three fundamental sources. And the secondary sources are commerce of any kind, you know, commerce, what we got right now, global commerce, trading, you know, whatever you want to call it, whatever you think of commerce as. And then number two, they're all equally important. And number two is of course the debt business. You know, you acquire debt, like for example, we hear in Washington that they're going to do fiscal stimulus, and that's of course that's a euphemism for government debt, as you know.
Exactly.
And then the third would be central banking power or policy, whereas you know everybody's kind of on Wall Street's waiting for Janet Yellen to give her opinion as to what she wants to do, and you know that's central banking power, setting interest rates and doing quantitative easing or you know whatever they do at the central banks. I'd say that's a pretty good summary, Dennis. But you know, go ahead and ask away.
Well, let's talk about your first fundamental source of economic growth, and that is energy for power. Can you give us a quick example?
Well, I think the best way to think of that is that you know you need to do some work. Now, for example, one of my sons is talking about diesel engines often, and he turned me on to diesel power, Rudolf Diesel. You know, so you have an engine there that can give you a lot of power. So you know, you either have human labor, you know, you and I working to build furniture, or you have a machine, or you know, you see, I mean, it's you can get a horse to do work for you. So I think you have energy, which then translates into power. And it can be any kind of power, you know. And of course, today we have the hydrocarbon power, you know, what they call fossil fuels. We're not sure they're fossil fuels, but you know, we have hydrocarbon power, and we burn that every day to get to work and so on. Do you think that's a pretty good idea there? Okay, yeah.
Well, let's talk about how this fits into these big cycles, Tom, and where we might be in these cycles. And I think our listeners are probably most interested in where do you see the world economy going moving ahead?
Yeah, that's the excellent question I was probably expecting you to ask that is, and I'll try to answer it. We try our best to know. It seems possible to me, from my perspective, that everything has peaked, say, around 2012, 2014 is possible. Now, we hear that world trade growth is shrinking quite dramatically, and I think that's been happening for a couple of years now. So it's possible that we have peaked, you know, in terms of commerce. The whole system may have peaked. I don't know yet, but you know, it's quite possible. So if that's true, Then I would think that this, I offered this idea last time we spoke, but if that's true, that we have to go through some sort of transition to what I call the third phase of history. That's a little bit more complicated. We can talk about this some other time maybe, but I think we will have to see the secondary sources, which are now pretty much compensating for the loss of the primary sources. We have to see the secondary sources really build out completely. That is, we'll have a huge amount of global commerce in the future compared to now, what we have now. We'll have a huge amount of debt, federal debt, all kinds of debt compared to now. And, you know, for example, if we have $20 trillion now or something like that, we might in 16 years double it twice and have something like $80 trillion. So I think what I would say is we would have even more intervention by the central banks around the world, including the United States, you know, for the next 16 years. So I would say that possibly, in fact, seems to be very likely that we can go another 16 years like we are right now. And then I think the wealth inequality, which you see growing and has been growing for about 30 years, since the fundamental sources kind of petered out, if you see what I'm trying to say, we've had this enormous growth in wealth inequality. And at some point, and I'm not a left-wing guy, but at some point, you know, you can't really drive that wealth inequality any further. That is, you know, the rich and the poor are real. There's a huge gap. And the whole system will implode. I'm not trying to predict that. I'm not really hoping to predict that, you know, we got another 16 years. But it seems plausible that that's the case. So we are at the very, very end of a big cycle, and it's likely, in my opinion, that the stock market will do pretty well for the next 16 years. Bonds will stay very strong, all kinds of bonds, and you know most people will be predicting gloom and doom, but it will never happen. And just when everybody's thinking, oh, we're okay, that's when we probably will have a very, very large contraction and, of course, decline in asset prices. That's my theory, Dennis.
Well, we're chatting today with Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom is the editor and publisher of World Affairs Monthly. And unfortunately, we are out of time for this segment, but I do have a question for Tom, and we will pick it up on the other side when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Hey, if you're not yet a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter, you should be, and it's easy to become a subscriber. This newsletter is delivered free every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time after the market closes. To become a subscriber, just visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com. That's your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. I'm chatting today with Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom is the editor and publisher of World Affairs Monthly, and I'm assuming that, Tom, just to pick it up where we left it off in the last segment, and for our listeners that may be joining us, you're a belief, you're of the belief that we're at the end of a big economic cycle, and you had outlined that there are three fundamental sources of economic growth. There's energy, efficiency, and adaptation. And maybe to paraphrase what you said, there are secondary drivers also, and that is commerce. There's increasing debt and central banking policy. And Tom, what I really wanted to do is get your take, because I happen to believe that we are nearing the end of a cycle as well. I don't know about the 16-year time frame we discussed, but we can set that aside for a minute.
Okay.
Let's take a look at just the accumulation of debt. I mean, I think if you take a look at the economic growth we've experienced in the last 25 or 30 years, you could argue that a lot of this growth in GDP is a result of debt-fueled consumption. In other words, people are borrowing money to go out and buy things.
No question.
And that can't continue forever. So isn't that really going to contribute to this transition period or this collapse in asset prices?
Yes. Now, I would confess to you and your audience that, you know, had you and I talked 10 years ago, I probably would have told you by now we would have a problem. But I grew to realize that, you know, there's quite a bit of room here, probably. You know, no one really knows, but it seems like we can accumulate even more debt and do more of what we're doing right now. I think before you called a couple of days ago this morning, I was looking at the numbers. I think we're now borrowing about the federal government. The deficit is about 15% of our spending, and it's about 18% of our receipts. You follow? I'm pretty sure that's about right. Your audience can check up on that. Check up on me. But and also, the other number to consider is that I believe we spend about $430 billion on debt service. That number can be had at the treasurydirect.gov website. Now, they do reduce that through some fancy accounting methods. I guess they earn some money, and they'll lower that number to about $260 billion, something like that. But the fact is, it appears that we spend about $400 billion, north of $400. And, of course, if you look at the receipts we have, that turns out to be about, I think, 12% of our government receipts, so 12%. So I'm just figuring, Dennis, that we could conceivably, if you look at that latest number, ratio I just gave you, you know, 12% of our spending goes to debt service. I'm kind of figuring that number will go to 25% or even 30%. And of course, at that point, we no longer have anything to brag about. There's going to be a very serious problem. You see what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Let me jump in here, Tom, because the one thing I would say to that, and just to maybe take an alternative position here, in a friendly way, of course.
Oh, of course. No. I figure you may not agree, and I get, but heck, this is, let's have a debate. Yes.
Yeah. Well, here's where I would say that that number may not be correct, and as you said, none of us know. Yeah. But if you take a look at healthcare spending alone is about 37% of federal spending today.
Right.
It's increasing at a rate of about 8% per year.
Yes. Yes.
Well, just the law of 72 tells us that will double in a period of 10 years. So when you look at all the pressures on spending, just taking a look at healthcare spending and interest on the debt, doesn't this have to blow up before 16 years?
I agree. I mean, I used to have that opinion too, Dennis. I really, if we had talked in 2007 and you know, I knew, in fact, I should politely boast here. I did predict that downturn that we saw in 08. I actually anticipated it by about 4 or 5 years. In fact, called it pretty much on the nail there, but, I figured that we would be deeply in trouble by now, and it seems that we are able to get away with what we're doing because interest rates are remaining and continuing to trend down. So I think, you know, you're right. There will be some problems, but we may be able to. But you know, you could be right, Dennis. I mean, let's see. I think, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong, really.
Well, let's back up here a minute too, because isn't part of the issue here that even though the United States has a $20 trillion debt, we've got another $1 trillion deficit coming up next year.
Yeah.
If you look around the world, you know, we're still, to quote my past guest Harry Dent, the U.S. is still probably the best house in a bad neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, Harry Dent and I go back about 20 years. I like the guy. I think that's possibly true, but the last time we talked, I think I may have told you that I forecast, or you know, my model, my theory tells me that the United States can't really survive this period of history here. We're just like Rome, so I think we're going to disappear like Rome. But yes, I mean we're the all powerful actor in the global arena here, obviously. And that means we can borrow a lot, as much as we want, almost infinite, at a very low price. But we do have big obligations, you know, big liabilities. So I mean, I know what Harry's saying, but I think it's a little bit more complex.
So is it your take, Tom, that just getting to something practical, that moving ahead, anticipating this asset price collapse, what would you advise our listeners to do with their own assets?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that in a personal way, so I don't offer investment advice, but I think I'm thinking that we probably have a period of stability here for another 10 to 15 years. I know many of your listeners may say, "Oh, come on, Tom, yeah, that can't be," but I wouldn't be surprised if we can get through this 10-15 years, you know, without any catastrophic situation. And in fact, you know, the stock market will just continue to go higher, and this bond market will stay very strong. Nothing strange will happen. Nothing, you know, horrible will happen. All that we'll see is more commerce, more debt of all kinds, and of course, more central banking intervention. And by the time that's, you know, getting pretty extreme, people will say, "Wait a minute, how could it go that far?" And just when they're really confident that maybe we're okay, that's when we're going to have a very serious decline in asset prices. And people will be bankrupted. I would say that most Americans, you know, 50% at least, will almost, I don't want to sound like a doom and gloomer, but, you know, they will be destitute.
Well, unfortunately, that is not a great place to leave it, but that's where we're going to have to leave it. Our guest today has been Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom is the editor and publisher of World Affairs Monthly. And, Tom, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I appreciate your perspective, and I would love to have you back.
Well, I look forward to it, Dennis. All the best to you.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this segment of the Everything Financial Radio program. But stay tuned, because after these words, I'll be joined by Mr. David Skarica, who is the author and publisher of the Addicted to Profits newsletter. I'll be talking to him about what's going to happen in the stock market in his view after the election. If you have an IRA or 401k, you won't want to miss that conversation. Stay with us. We'll be back.
Give me your money.
This is the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Glad you tuned in today. Hey, I said this at the outset of the program, but if you're just joining us, let me remind you of a free resource that we have available. We get approached all the time, particularly when we have guests here on the program that talk about the continued devaluation of currencies worldwide, central banking policies that make your money buy less this year than it did last year. And often I'm asked, should I buy gold or silver? Should I buy metals? And we have a report titled, Should I Buy Metals? And you can get a free copy of this report that'll give you some different perspectives and answer some questions you may have. All you have to do is visit the website, shouldibuymetals.com. The website, again, is shouldibuymetals.com. And when you visit the website, you'll be asked to give us your name and the address to which you'd like to have the report be mailed, and that report will be sent to you free of charge and without any further obligation. The website, again, shouldibuymetals.com. I am pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. David Skarica. David's newsletter, Addicted to Profits, is a very popular newsletter and one that I would encourage you to check out. If you'd like to get more information, you can go to addictedtoprofits.net. David, to give you a little bit of his background, at the age of 18, became the youngest person on record to pass the Canadian Securities Course, and his work now is primarily helping his subscribers make profits. So, David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, what are you telling your readers right now about the health of U.S. stock market indices?
Well, there's really not much going on. It's actually been about 46 days, I think, by my count, and 34 trading days, where essentially the market's been in this really, really tight range. And to use the Dow, it's about 18,000 on the downside and about 18,400. On the upside, so it's 2%. So that's really nothing is going on. Now, maybe some individual stocks have had big moves up and down, but really these companies, like market itself, is doing quote-unquote like nothing. And what I foresee happening is we're going to talk a little more about economic policy later, but even technically, I think after the election, we will begin a sell-off, and it's really simple. If you go look at the TLT, which is the long-term bond ETF, it's actually breaking down right now and going to multi-month lows. A lot of interest rates all over the world, like in Germany, Italy, UK, US, are all going to multi-month highs. So I think that is suggesting worries over the Fed raising rates later in the year. So it's either I think we get one of two things happening. Either, you know, Trump wins, and there's this kind of sell on fear, especially by foreign investors, trade, and or Hillary wins, and then I think the shift then turns to the Fed, and kind of like late last year when the stocks didn't do so well from about the early November top into into January, I think then you get worries over the Fed. But if you go look at a lot of technical indicators, the stocks, the percent of the stocks over their 20, 50, and 200-day moving average, the number of new highs, all of these things are really actually signaling that the market is running out of steam. A lot of stocks are not acting very well. We've seen a lot of companies like Southwest Airlines, like Under Armour, actually gap down quite badly on their earnings. So I really think that the market is losing steam. And then after this earnings season, it will sell off. And one thing that's really interesting about this earnings season opposed to last year was last year, a lot of companies like J&J, for example, they announced new large buyback programs, even though their earnings weren't great. And that actually caused the companies to do quite well. What I'm seeing this year is there is almost no announcements of new or extensions of old buyback programs. And if you go look at ETF outflows, mutual fund outflows, insider selling, what institutional investors are doing, everybody is selling stocks. The only real inflow were companies buying back, you know, were stock buybacks. So I really think this is going to be very negative for the market after the earnings season. And sometimes this can happen. Like, for example, last year when the market sold off in August of 2015, we kind of got through the earnings in July of 2015, and the market sold off the next month. And, you know, that kind of happened again, too, in November, December of 2015 as well, after the market peaked in late October, early November. So I think we could see this kind of post-earnings sell-off rather than everyone thinks that we'll get this end-of-the-year Santa Claus rally. But what I'm seeing technically and what I'm seeing, you know, from the earnings season and the lack of stock buybacks, you know, coming back into the market. And by the way, just, you know, on principle, I disagree with a lot of the stock buybacks, but I'm also smart enough to know that they were actually really driving the market the last few years. I really believe that these stocks are the, you know, can the sell off going to the end of the year. And I've watched those yields on bonds because the one thing about the market right now, one reason the market has been able to stay overvalued is because there's this whole thing. Well, the German bond is negative. The UK bond is 1%. The US bond is 1.5%. Of course, I'd rather be in, you know, a large cap stock that's yielding 3%. But of course, if we see a backup in these interest rates, that defeats that argument and could cause a lot of stocks, especially dividend-oriented stocks, to sell off.
And just if you're just joining us, listeners, we are chatting today with David Skorica. David's newsletter is Addicted to Profits. You can get more information at addictedtoprofits.net. And, David, as you were talking about some of the technical indicators that you're looking at, I think I read just this past week that median price earnings ratios on the S&P 500 are now higher than they were in 1929 and I think in the 92nd percentile in market history. I think they were a bit higher at the tech stock bubble peak. But I don't know if you've heard that same thing or read that same thing, but that's a big that's a huge, huge red flag.
Actually, median price to sales are higher than they were at the tech stock peak. Because what you have to understand about 2000, that's about when I got started in the markets, the late 90s, was we had two markets back then, and a lot of the, you know, the so-called old economy stocks, they were not trading at lofty valuations, you know, like the, you know, 3M, you know, those kind of stocks. But a lot of the tech stocks, of course, were sky high, and a lot of the dot-coms were just, you know, complete bubbles and companies that all went to the wayside. But right now what's happening is basically the whole market's expensive because people are desperate in this kind of, you know, this move for yield, as they call it, you know, the whatnot. We're seeing these stocks all over extended all over the market. And one, again, these buybacks kind of do that because what the buybacks do is when you decrease the number of shares you have outstanding, you can inflate your earnings per share, right? So, but when you and keep them, you know, make it look like your stock's still trading at a lower valuation, but you can keep that earnings per share with lower sales. So the problem with that is with no sales, there's no growth, and there's no room for the market to move up. And I think what's going on with the market now is you've kind of got this belief that the central banks can come to the rescue, and that's putting a floor under it. And then you kind of got this belief that, this fact that it's really overvalued and there's no growth, so the market can't rally, right, to the upside. So that's why you've got this really, really tight trading range. But what I want to expand on is the tighter this range gets and the longer it goes on for, and like I said, it's been going on, as we're talking here, in late October for almost a month and a half, the bigger, in my opinion, the break is going to be. That happened in the summer of last year where the market did nothing for months and months and months, and then when it broke really hard in August 2015. So I think the longer this no volatility range goes on, the bigger the break is going to come, you know, when it finally breaks. And like I said, the technicals are all like setting up for. You know, those overvaluation things, they've been there for a while. But the technicals, the stocks over the moving averages, the sentiment indicators showing people very complacent, the VIX being low, we're all there right now for kind of a break. And I think we're entering an interesting point in history where we've seen the pound tank after the British Central Bank foolishly cut rates and printed money after the Brexit vote. We've seen the Japanese yen rally earlier this year, even after the Japan went negative rates and wanted to keep the yen depressed. So what I'm saying is, I think we're seeing the German bond now starting to back up in yield. We're seeing the slow cracking in the central bank policies and what the central bankers want to do. So I think at some point it's going to be obvious that these policies that have worked in keeping markets inflated at some point is going to, you know, go 180 and turn against them. And then they'll kind of lose control of the market. And we're going to talk about the policy later on. But anyhow, I think the technicals are right there for a setup for an end-of-the-year sell-off. I sort of gave up on kind of maybe the possibility of September-October correction or bear market, which has, of course, happened in times like 1929, 1987, 1998, 2008, et cetera. I kind of gave up on that in about mid to late September because I noticed the market just wasn't volatile enough for that setup to occur. But then I kind of came up with this thesis where I really think that the market, because of the deteriorating technicals, can probably sell off, you know, in the November, December timeframe rather than there being, you know, some rally. And one of the most important things going forward here as well you have to watch is watch the Chinese yuan. The Chinese yuan is at 6-year lows. China has a huge banking bubble in crisis, a huge property bubble. They are where the U.S. was in 2007, 2008. They are going to have to bail out their banks, and that means their currency is going to have to adjust for the private debt being put on the public balance sheet, similar to what happened in the West in 2008. And when that occurs, the yuan will have to readjust to that. And with a yuan devaluation, that is very deflationary. That is not good for a lot of industrial commodities. That means China will be exporting deflation. And that will be bad for global markets and global liquidity.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today is Mr. David Skorica, and he will be joining us again in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Glad you decided to listen in today. Hey, if you haven't yet ordered this, it's a brand new free report available from PLP Services titled, Should I Buy Metals? If you've been wondering whether or not you should own gold or silver in your portfolio, this is a report that you'll want to pick up. It's free. It's delivered to you at no cost and without further obligation. You can get the report by visiting the website shouldibuymetals.com. The website again is shouldibuymetals.com. Also, if you would like to learn how to potentially maximize your Social Security benefits, we have another free resource available for you. We have two Social Security maximization workshops coming up, one on Tuesday, November 8th, one on Thursday, November 10th. On Tuesday, November 8th, we'll be at Sunnybrook Country Club. On Thursday, November 9, we'll be at the 84th Street Pub and Grill. Both of these meetings begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. We will talk about different ways to maximize your Social Security benefits under the new rules. If you're between the ages of 55 and 69, we would encourage you to attend. It's easy to register. All you have to do is visit the website socialsecurityradio.com. SocialSecurityRadio.com is the website to register for these free Social Security Maximization workshops or get more information while capacity remains. Again, the website, SocialSecurityRadio.com. Joining me on today's Everything Financial Radio program is Mr. David Skorica. David's newsletter is Addicted to Profits. You can get more information about his newsletter at addictedtoprofits.net. And David, you made a comment in the last segment. I just want to jump right back in again that This time, when we see a market correction, which you were thinking could potentially happen yet this year, that the Fed's not in a position to get control over that. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think that it's twofold. Number one, right now they're talking about raising interest rates. So when we had these other corrections in 2010, 2011, they were still doing QE. You know, they did the twist, and then they did the big QE in 2012. They've already raised rates once, and they're already talking about raising interest rates. So I actually am not like this conspiracy theorist, and I think, or not conspiracy theorist, but I'm not so jaded to think, oh, they never want to raise rates. They're never going to do it again. I actually think they do want to raise rates very slowly to 1% or 1.25%, so they have some leeway when the next downturn comes. And I think they're not that stupid to think that something bad cannot happen to occur. But I think what's happening is people are seeing the limitations of monetary policy. They're seeing really all it does is help asset markets and real estate markets, and doesn't really help the real economy. You know, obviously with the rise of like Sanders and Trump and the populist right-wing parties in Europe, there's a lot of discontent, and printing money and pumping the Dow isn't exactly helping that discontent, right? If anything, might be increasing it. So I think that people are going to realize there's only so much they can do. And at some point, I think what will happen, and maybe we're starting to see this in Europe, like I said, where the German bond is now starting to creep up in yield, where the British, you know, were doing a QE program and got the 10-year bond there down to 0.5%. Now it's at 1.25%. So it's more than doubled from its lows, despite the fact that they're doing a form of QE in the UK. So I think at some point, when the debts are too big, you'll see this revolt in the bond markets. I think that's the real key, where, you know, the 10-year yield starts spiking higher, and that kills the corporate debt market, that kills the stock buybacks, which is driving the stock market, that kills this valuation trade where people just want to own dividend stocks because yields are so low, and that's when they kind of lose control. They have to lose control of the bond market. I think that coincides with the next recession, because in the next recession, when you have a shrinking economy, you get the deficit probably back up to over $1 trillion a year, and then the debt as compared to GDP is probably growing at 10% a year, meaning, you know, you got a 5% deficit and you got, you know, a 4 or 5% shrinkage in the economy over a couple of year period. So that really, I think, could be the nail in the coffin. Basically, at some point, the debts are just going to get to be too large. Now, what they're trying to do right now is really simple, in my opinion. By just doing rate increases very slowly, I think the Fed, if you go look at some of the comments by Fisher, the former Dallas Fed chairman, they basically know, and you know, Yellen has said that biotech stocks were overvalued and all that sort of thing. They know that the market is overvalued. They know it might even be a bubble. But what they want to do is try to keep this kind of zombie stock market, I call it, where I mentioned earlier, there is no volatility right now. There is nothing going on. They want to keep the market kind of just trending sideways and hope that the economy, the real economy, can grow into that. And they can, you know, keep off a crash, but, you know, they also don't want it to have one more huge orgy run up and turn into a massive bubble. So I think they're walking this very fine line and walking a tightrope, or, you know, whatever you want to say, you know, putting the pin in the string through the needle, right? So I don't think it's going to work, and I think it will blow up in their face because there's so many danger spots in the world. Like I said, the yuan, you know, something like Deutsche Bank blowing up, a big emerging market like Turkey potentially having a currency crisis. There's so many areas of the world that could cause the next crisis that's beyond their control. You know, I think that, you know, this will not work, and at some point it will all kind of fall apart at once. And I think obviously there is a political element to what's going on with their policy right now, because look, they can say what they want to say, but I think most of us know that when you have someone like Trump, you know, publicly chastising them and criticizing them, well, of course, they're going to be in favor of the other candidate. You know, if it was someone like Rubio and Clinton, I don't think they'd really care. You know, I don't think they really cared when it was Romney and Obama. But when you have a kind of populist candidate, they're probably inclined to try to prop everything up into the election so, you know, their candidate can kind of win. You know, and a lot of Fed members have given to the Democratic campaign, you know, public filings. So, anyhow, but I think so, you know, that's what they're trying to do right now is write this, walk this tightrope, keep the markets propped up into the election, and then see what happens after that. And they still want to do that one interest rate hike. But this is where it gets really dangerous, because I mentioned the yuan earlier. Every other central bank in the world, the UK, Europe, Japan, Canada, Australia, everywhere, is doing some form of loosening policy or not doing anything, you know, or QE, whatever it is. But at some point, they're all dovish. And the Fed is talking about raising rates. Even if it's just another quarter or another half a percent, it's policy divergence. It's the U.S. raising rates while the rest of the world is loosening. And that's a very dangerous policy divergence. And remember, it doesn't usually happen that way. In the 2000s, after the dot-com bust, the U.S. raised rates while everyone else around the world raised rates. They cut rates in the financial crisis when everyone else cut rates. So this policy divergence is what can cause these dislocations and for probably the market to have a big fall. And one, another thing to watch, I mentioned the yuan falling, is watch the U.S. dollar, too. The U.S. dollar going up isn't like king dollar or it isn't king dollar or you know, the U.S. being stronger than everyone. The U.S. dollar going higher is actually a sign of global liquidity tightening. It happened in 2001, 2002 during the bear market. It happened in 2008 during the bear market. So if the U.S. dollar breaks through that dollar, that high it made in early 2015, I would think that we're going to see some kind of liquidity event and the market move lower, which is, by the way, even though I'm kind of seen as a commodities guy, I'm not that bullish on industrial commodities right now. I'm not bullish on commodities outside of gold and silver as kind of a hedge play, because what I think that you need right now is for this washout to occur and then the government to come in and the central banks to come in with printing money and stimulus programs, and then you can see a rally in commodities. But until that happens, commodities are best will flatline, and then we can see one more bust lower, especially if the China bubble decreases. And just as a quick note, if you look up Jim Chanos or Kyle Bass or George Soros, they all have excellent interviews and articles on the Chinese bubble on the internet, if you really want to look at it in more detail.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. David Skorica. His newsletter is Addicted to Profits, and David, the website for that is addictedtoprofits.net, if our listeners want to check it out. Is that right?
Yes, that's what it is. And just so you know, I do special deals to the newsletter every so often.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Well, that about does it for this week's Everything Financial Radio program, brought to you by PLP Services. Be sure to listen in next week when I'll be joined by a really remarkable guest. Her name is Hazel Henderson, and I'll be talking to Hazel about a movement that's going on worldwide that she believes will soon make central banks obsolete. You won't want to miss that interview that I'll do with Hazel on next week's program. As I said, that's all the time I have for this week. Hope you got something you can use, and I'll be back again next week. Be sure to tune in. Bye.